This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Alan Saunders, and this is the Philosopher's Zone. This year, as you might know, is the 150th anniversary of the birth of Sigmund Freud. Now, does he belong on a show like this? He started off as a medical practitioner. He came to regard himself as a scientist of the mind. Now, I seem to recall that the great philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein said that psychology is not necessarily more philosophical than any other subject, but I think we can agree that there is something philosophical in some of Freud's thought, especially in a late work like his essay Civilization and Its Discontents, which was published in 1930. Now, with a title like that, it could be a work of philosophy, it could be a work of psychoanalysis, of history, or of sociology. So what exactly is it? Here's Professor David Tuckett from the Psychoanalysis Unit at University College London.
Well, it's one of Freud's later works, 1930, and there he's interested in looking at the way in which what he calls the instincts and basic driving forces of mankind, how they are tamed or not by civilization. Broadly speaking, there are two things that the book did. The first was that he had the idea that the major problem civilization had was taming a basic destructive drive. And if this destructive drive is turned outwards against people, obviously you don't have civilization. And so it had in some way to be turned inwards. And out of this, he got the idea of something which is very much in the culture called the superego. It's, of course, only a concept, not a real thing. But inside our minds, we have this sense of something called the superego, which keeps us from doing things that we shouldn't. It's like our conscience. And Freud argued that the kind of force for this superego comes from the destructive instinct being turned upon each person. This means that for him, civilization always involved a certain amount of unease that the person had but isn't really fully conscious of. So he was interested in the way in which, in a way, through being civilized, we have to give up something.
These days we have plenty of people, and they were around in Freud's day as well, who will tell us that the benefits of civilization are not worth the pains that are inflicted upon us in gaining these benefits, and they're not quite the pains that Freud had in mind. The latest example would be somebody like Jared Diamond, who says that agriculture, as opposed to hunting and gathering, agriculture, of course, leads to structured societies and to cities and therefore to civilization, that really we shouldn't have gone down that route in the first place. And Freud similarly refers in the book to people who yearn back to a mythical picture of the noble savage and of the life of paradise. Is he addressing that sort of disdain for civilization?
Well, one of the ways you can look at the two basic instincts he talks about, he calls them the loving instinct, eros, and the destructive instinct, thanatos, is to see the eros as basically an instinct towards linking things up, joining things up, including being within human social groups. Thanatos, the destructive instinct, being exactly that, to go against being part of things, breaking things up, breaking links, and not being part of human groups. So that tension he would see very much at the heart of society and of the individual, and inherent, that is, you can never get away from it, it's always there. So if we take up your question, human civilization takes place in groups. We're adapted to groups from many hundreds of thousands of years ago, the beginning of humankind. But there's always going to be that tension between working together and working individually. Working together, we achieve a great deal more. We wouldn't be where we are now. For example, trade, everything involves working with other people. But on the other hand, major innovation, for example, occurs through things that happen within individuals often. So that tension is there and is, I think, always going to be there.
Does he distinguish between stages of civilization? I mean, obviously you could say that people in the European Middle Ages were civilized, but it's very, very easy to idealize their state by saying, well, look, you lived in the same village all your life, you knew the same people, there wasn't too much, short of the odd war or a plague, that would disrupt your enjoyment of life. It's not as disruptive as the modern world.
Not really. I mean, Freud is not really differentiating different stages.
This does then bring us to the question of how the work is to be read. I mean, is it categorizable? It's obviously not a scientific treatise, but it's not a historical or sociological monograph either.
At the time the work was written, it would have seemed highly speculative. And part of Freud's motive in writing it was not just to contribute to the understanding of society and the issues we've just been discussing, but also it led to this understanding of the superego as a major part of the human personality. Now, with the passage of time, I think Freud's work has actually stood the test of time much more than you would expect, not through the metaphors, but through trying to understand it in modern terms. For instance, the whole issue of guilt is, I think you don't have to look very far to see that we all struggle either with guilt or with the consequences of not recognising we feel guilty. For instance, in Australia, you have an issue, I know, with the Aboriginal peoples and what is the relationship between the settlers and the Aboriginal peoples. Now, there, of course, you can ignore the problem, which is, I think, really what happened for a long time. In recent years, there's been much more interest in that, in novels, in history, in society and politics. And in a way, this brings up one of Freud's key points, that unconscious guilt, that is, guilt you don't know about, can affect you so that you have an uneasy feeling that this land, which I call mine, perhaps wasn't exactly mine. And there's a novel called The Secret River, which deals with this issue of the difficult feelings and all the complex issues around the resettlement of Australia and how working through guilt, that is, coming to realise there was a history, things did happen, although it may be painful at the time, it makes you feel better to get these issues sorted out.
Well, I think I have two questions arising from that. One is, does he have a concept of guilt as being collective, or is it individual? Can a society have unrecognised guilt?
Well, I think ultimately all feelings belong to individuals, but different human groups can deal with the situation in which they're in collectively, so that one of the things that happens, for example, if you take the Nazi period in Germany, is that people could identify with the way Hitler was carrying on against the Jews, and they didn't at the time, or most people didn't, feel guilty about what was happening, but perhaps they were uncomfortable. If I just give you an example, you take someone who is encouraged to hit or treat badly someone else, they do that, then they feel uncomfortable, but they're not conscious of it. Instead of being aware they feel uncomfortable for hitting somebody, what they feel is that that person makes them feel bad, so they hit them again and again and again, and in the end what you want to do is kill them, or at least eradicate them from your existence. So these things happen in the individual, but groups can help or not people to recognise what's happening. One of the things that I'll be talking about in my talk is that, for example, the English psychoanalyst Bion talked about what happens in groups and how groups can share basic assumptions to do with the way they manage anxiety, for example.
And my other question arising from the example you give is, I do know people who would say, with regard to white Australia's relationship with the indigenous people of this country, that guilt's neither here nor there. What we really want are practical measures that will improve Aboriginal living standards, will improve education, will improve life expectancy and so on. And that really has nothing to do with guilt.
First of all, I'm sure that these practical measures are important, but the way feelings come in is you don't have any choice about them. They're either there or they're not there, and then after that you either recognise them or you don't. So on the part of the settlers, I think there would be somewhere, and most people would think, well, we've actually taken something. Somewhere along the line something was taken, and that produces a feeling of having stolen something. If you're aware of it, you can think about it and you can see it in proportion. Then on the other side, that is on the Aboriginal side, there will be a feeling of having something stolen from you. There will be grievance. Now, again, by knowing that you have a grievance, you can think about it rather than spend your whole life dominated by it. If these two sets of feelings, grievance and guilt, can be thought about, it'll be more easy to get down, usually, I think, to the practical business of saying, well, OK, how do we resolve this by making arrangements between us, not forever one side having grievance and the other side feeling eternal guilt.
Can we return to the superego? I've heard a number of critics say that one of the problems with understanding Freud is that we've saddled ourselves with the translations of his technical terms, which were in many cases originally arrived at by his first translator, Strachey, James Strachey, and that they actually sound rather more approachable in the original German. So can you enlarge a bit on the concept of the superego? What is it? It's the I over me, as it were?
Yes. Well, I think what you're saying is absolutely true. As I understand it, in German, Freud's language reads very colloquially, and he indeed won prizes, literary prizes, for his writing, whereas Ernest Jones and James Strachey wanted to make it sound terribly official and proper, and because they were worried about what he says about sex and things like that. And this does mean it's a bit distant. I think the superego is a simple idea in that it is literally a sense of being watched over by something. For example, when you feel a little bit uncomfortable, and if you think of when you feel slightly guilty, it is a bit associated with kind of looking over your shoulder, mentally speaking, as to what's going on behind you. And so I think it does have, once you've got the meaning of it, I think it does have quite a nice intuitive feel that there's sort of someone watching. And of course, as you know, Freud's idea is that our idea about fear of punishment and fear of having done wrong is based on the way we think of how our parents treated us. Our ideas about that are always exaggerated for Freud. That is, however badly parents treated us, and of course in some cases parents treated people appallingly, the child always tends to exaggerate it because the child sees the way the parent is through its own tending to be highly aggressive basic wishes, the idea, you know, I want it, why can't I have it, I'll take it, and then being frightened of the parent wanting it bigger, stronger, taking it back. So this, I think, is quite a lively model once you've appreciated it a bit.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Professor David Tuckett from the Psychoanalysis Unit at University College London about Sigmund Freud's book Civilization and Its Discontents, and that watcher over your shoulder, the superego. Now, of course, the biggest watcher over your shoulder is God. So what about God?
Well, Freud, in another related work, The Future of the Illusion, tackles that, in which God, effectively, is an idea which, for Freud, is the superego, so that this God represents a projection of the individual superego into the eternal, basically.
Freud was medically trained, of course, and he aspired to making a contribution to science, but how do we regard a concept like the superego? Do we see it as a scientific concept like those arrived at by his contemporaries, like relativity, like Schrödinger's wave equation, or is it a metaphor or what?
I think all concepts are really not exactly true or false, but are useful or not. And so I think the idea of the superego is just a way of trying to describe what in fact are a very complex set of processes. The processes rest on the interest psychoanalysts have in feelings or emotions. Now, in that respect, Freud's early ideas, as you know, he started life really as a neuroscientist. He was quite a top neuroscientist of his day, working in a top laboratory. And it was because he couldn't understand certain things going on with hysterics that he turned from neuroscience to psychoanalysis. Now, in recent years, neuroscientists have found themselves coming back, in fact, to the kinds of ideas that Freud was having. So that, for example, the centrality of emotion in human life is beginning to be recognised. For instance, whereas it's common to think that emotions stand in the way of making good, sensible, rational decisions, in fact, we now are beginning to believe that good decision-making requires emotions, because you can't actually, as economists, for example, argue, do huge numbers of calculations, even if you've got a lot of computers. You do things quickly and efficiently, and you partly do things because it feels right to do something. And this is the way in which we're actually biologically programmed through feelings to help us actually live. And undoubtedly, feelings, the basis of which something like the superego is based on feeling bad about things. These, I think, are probably ultimately biologically conditioned. And so Freud's metaphor there probably stands for a lot of complex processes, which I think in the next 50 to 100 years will be better understood. But at the end result, I think the concept of the superego will probably stand as a useful one.
But if neurophysiology got really, really, really clever, would it be worth looking for the seat of the superego in the brain?
Well, as you may know, current neurophysiology is much more about the relationships between parts of the brain. So the idea of a bit of the brain doing this, I think, is already probably disproved. But it is about complex relationships, because the brain also evolved, you know, so that the brain, our brain, is made up, so to speak, of the simpler brains of earlier animals, earlier primates. And as the brain got more complicated, so it added these functions. So I think that it won't be that you'll see the superego, but you can see already, if you put people in these scans that they use, you can see areas lighting up and things happening when people are, so to speak, thinking. And one of the interesting things about that work is you see similar things occurring if you give people an idea of something as opposed to if you give them the actual experience.
Karl Popper, one of Freud's critics, said that the trouble with Freud was that you did not have in his works any falsifiable hypotheses. And to put that in terms of the superego, he would have said that there are no discoveries that you could make that would lead you to suspect that the superego doesn't exist. Therefore, it is not a scientific notion, because scientific concepts should always be vulnerable to being proved false or being proved invalid. In that sense, is the superego a falsifiable hypothesis?
I think that the issue of falsifying things actually depends on the skill or imagination one has in setting up the test. You could start like this. I think few of us would disagree with the idea that there's a feeling called guilt that we can share between us, although it is ultimately a subjective feeling. I don't know exactly what you feel when you feel guilt, but we can probably compare. So once you've got ideas of guilt and once you've got the links between them, I think then it's a question of, well, does the superego add anything? You know, if we have the theory of the superego, just as if we have the theory of the destructive drives or things of this kind, does it make sense of a situation better than you have an alternative theory? In this way, I don't think psychoanalysis is any different from any other scientific discipline, although the nature of the way you set up the tests are somewhat different. I mean, the underlying point here is really that psychoanalysis, I think, is the only serious discipline that looks at the experience of subjectivity. And the whole difficulty is, how do you look at subjectivity in a rigorous way? You clearly can't say you look at subjectivity only objectively, or there's nothing to investigate. So that's the inherent difficulty, but it's not unique to psychoanalysis.
Well, yes, it's perhaps for reasons similar to this that a lot of Freud's admirers today want to say, well, we really see him not as a scientist of the mind, but as an imaginative artist, as a writer. But you sound as though you're holding out for the rather older idea of him as a scientist of the mind.
I have a somewhat broader view of science, but I think that it's very important that psychoanalysis is seen as a discipline which can make statements which can claim to have greater truth than just if any other person says it without the discipline. I think it makes no sense otherwise, really. So that the underlying issue would be with psychoanalysis, like actually with economics or sociology or social anthropology or other disciplines, you have to construct an argument, and then you have to think, well, what arguments are there against this? And it's that way of thinking, rather than thinking there's definitely a simple way of validating it with a particular form of investigation, like an experiment.
A few years ago, I was talking to a psychoanalyst, not as a patient, but at a party, and I was talking about the Oresteia, the great trilogy by the Greek tragedian Aeschylus. And I was saying, well, this is a story of a father who sacrifices his daughter, the mother who then kills the father, the son who goes seeking revenge, threatening destruction to all around, until finally the matter is only resolved by the gods descending in the third part of the trilogy and essentially bringing order to the city. And he said, yes, it sounds like you've been reading Melanie Klein, the psychoanalyst, which I hadn't, by the way, though I have now after he said this. But is that the sort of pattern of the superego, as it were, coming to be born and powerfully and poetically embodied in those plays?
Yes. The way I'd put it rather is this, is that the Greek tragedies, and what is great about them and why they've lasted, is that they describe fundamental human problems of experience and existence, which they dramatized, as with Shakespeare and things like that. And they are, so to speak, true because they're part of human experience. And in a way, that relates to your point about science. It wouldn't make sense to say, is it true or not? I think we all recognize these fundamental issues that are addressed in such dramas. Then Klein or Freud or the other psychoanalyst, or indeed any other person, if their theories are valid, they should naturally relate to the same type of phenomena. In other words, the theses in the tragedies, if your psychological theory is any good, would highlight them a bit. And that's roughly what I'd say. In regard to superego and civilization's discontents, the centrality of the Oedipus complex, or broadly speaking, the relationship between child and parents, the relationship between the parents in the child's mind, and the individual relationships between each child and each parent and their various vicissitudes, that makes up, according to Freud, the stuff of life and the stuff of emotions, and it's out of that that human personality is formed, starting with feelings about guilt, identification, and so on. And these are brilliantly set out in Aeschylus and the other classic tragedies.
While we're on a literary bent, there are very few writers, but I can think of a couple, who take the view that civilization is constant work, that it means self-restraint, it means discipline, it's always on the verge of collapse. We really need to keep a hold on things in order to prevent that collapse. Conrad, the novelist, is one of them. Kipling is another. Is that Freud's view of civilization?
Yes, I think it's very much. I mean, the last, I can't quote it to you exactly, but the last words of Civilization, Its Discontents, of course, written, I think it's a footnote actually, written as the events in Germany are being anticipated, he ends up by saying, only time will show how these things develop. So he very much sees the struggle between the life instincts, that's to combine, to be with each other, and destructivity, especially with the development of human capacity for destructivity, as a constant ongoing battle. I'd add to your list, I think, Tolstoy, in fact, who I think in his work is very much interested in these phenomena.
Professor Tuckett, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for this week, but don't forget about our website at abc.net.au/rn/philosopher's zone, which is the place to go if you want to hear the last 4 weeks of Philosopher's Zones or to download and pod them. The show is produced by Polly Rickard with technical production by Janita Palmer. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be philosophising with you again next week.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programmes, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.